Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Risk Map podcast, produced by Control Risks, the global political, integrity, and security risk consultancy. In this episode, we'll look ahead over the next 2 weeks, from the 7th to the 20th of June, 2014. I'm Charles Hecker, Global Research Director for Global Risk Analysis based here in London.
And I'm Michael Moran, Managing Director of Global Risk Analysis in New York. Chuck, what's on our risk radar for the next 2 weeks?
Mike, some of the things coming up in the next fortnight include Kosovo, which is holding a snap parliamentary election on Sunday, the 8th of June. Ethnic Serb parties relented in their threat to boycott the ballot, but the vote could still stoke tension. Sunday the 14th brings a runoff in the election to replace Afghan President Hamid Karzai. Abdullah Abdullah, Karzai's former foreign minister, leads Ashraf Ghani, a former Karzai finance minister, in most polls. Then on Sunday the 15th of June, another runoff. This one in Colombia pits incumbent President Juan Manuel Santos against the protege of his powerful predecessor Juan Uribe. Our Bogota office has Santos tipped for a second term.
Thanks, Chuck. But this week, we are going to drill down on three other topics: a new Palestinian unity government, the opening of the World Cup in Brazil, and tensions between China and Vietnam.
Mike, let's start in Asia. China's determination to press its claim to much of the South China Sea has many of its neighbors upset, but none more so than Vietnam, which fought a short, brutal border war with the Chinese in 1979. On the 1st of May, China towed an oil rig into one of the disputed zones near the Paracel Island chain. Chinese patrol craft have rammed Vietnamese ships and in one case sinking a fishing boat and touching off rioting that forced Beijing to evacuate thousands of its citizens from Vietnam. Joining to discuss the complex risks in this scenario is Andrew Gillum, our head of analysis for Asia Pacific, and he's joining me from Seoul, Korea. Andy, there's a pretty strong feeling in the West that China may have misplayed its hand here. Isn't this just reinforcing the trend of Asian countries increasingly seeing China as a threat and aligning more with the United States and with each other to hedge that threat?
Well, basically, yes. I think that's the reaction and the direction we're seeing from a lot of countries in the region in response to this pretty significant escalation. The incident in 2012 between China and the Philippines, and now this incident with Vietnam, have really been game changers, I guess, for those countries in terms of creating a much greater appetite for cooperation with the US and also potentially now with each other between Manila and Hanoi on international arbitration. Beyond the directly most affected countries as well, we've seen a lot more nervousness. I mean, even Malaysia has been uncharacteristically vocal on the subject recently, which I think shows how widely some of these fears about China are being felt. And I guess what's most worrying probably about this incident is that it seems so deliberate, the moving of the oil rig into the disputed areas, whereas most of the previous incidents had at least some spontaneous element or some element of both sides up in the ante. So I think in a lot of ways, the outlook is definitely more concerning now than it's ever been before.
So Andy, if this is the result of the oil rig move, then don't we have to ask why China would stir up this situation right before the significant ASEAN and regional security meetings that we saw last month, where China's actions inevitably ended up in the spotlight? And what does it tell us to expect from Beijing in the months and maybe even in the years ahead?
There's definitely quite a bit of confusion about the timing of this move, and it does seem odd. I think the only conclusion we can draw really is that China is actually not as concerned anymore about opinion on this. I think a lot of Chinese observers themselves don't really buy into the nine dashed line claim to the whole South China Sea, and it's a bit more nuanced than that. I think some specific claims are more intensely held than others. And I think, you know, we shouldn't underestimate the significance of that feeling or the clear, realist strategic logic for China to push these claims and to try and reduce U.S. maritime influence in the region. Of course, anything China does to try and change the status quo is alarming to its neighbors, but I guess what we've seen from China in the last few years is that they're now willing to cause that alarm and maybe even want a bit of that alarm to serve notice, if you like, that it doesn't accept this status quo.
So Andy, just in conclusion, a real bottom line question here, and how do we see this trajectory that you describe impacting business in the region? These tensions have been around for a long time without ever seriously denting the trend of extremely robust growth in regional trade and investment around China. Do you think that that's at the risk of changing now?
I think there is some risk of that. Certainly the most likely scenario is still one where, you know, there's a bit of brinkmanship on these issues, but nobody involved wants a major conflict. But I think we shouldn't underestimate how firmly not only China, but also Vietnam and the Philippines are willing to stand on these issues. So we've definitely got scope for the kind of the bilateral economic punishment that you sometimes see. But the broader risk and the scarier risk is that some of what we're seeing is a precursor to a more serious deterioration in U.S.-China relations, and that would obviously have wider implications for Western businesses. So I think what has traditionally been the stuff of think tank discussions, if you like, about issues in the South China Sea could be a factor, and I think in, you know, the kind of business politics overlap that would be a lot more worrying to firms if that started to get out of hand.
Andy, thank you very much. That's Andy Gillum, head of analysis for Asia Pacific, joining me today from Seoul, Korea.
It was 7 years ago, June of 2007, that the Palestinian militant movement Hamas turned on the governing Fatah movement and drove them out of the Gaza Strip. Ever since, the division has created an insurmountable hurdle, some would say convenient excuse, that prevented progress in the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. But now the rift is mended, and a unity government is in place.
But Mike, this has its own complications, as Colleen Shepp, our Middle East analyst, explains. Colleen, tell me a little bit about the risk that the Palestinian Authority gets cut off from Israeli trade, for example, or even from the Israeli job market. What sort of challenges does that pose to the PA going forward?
It is very likely that Israel will go ahead and impose certain sanctions on the Palestinian Authority now that it has announced a unity government encompassing both Hamas and Fatah. Well, one tried and tested retaliatory tactic that Israel often employs is the withholding of tax revenues that it collects on the behalf of the Palestinian Authority. But I don't believe it will go that much further than that. This has got a couple of reasons. First of all, Israel itself benefits a fair bit from trade with the Palestinians. About 90% of West Bank imports are Israeli. More broadly and almost more importantly, though, Israel actually has quite little interest in driving the West Bank towards a total economic collapse. And the reason for this is that it would likely force Israel to start taking care of the West Bank's quite onerous day-to-day running, something that it can now outsource to the Palestinian Authority. And it actually quite likes that status quo. So for its own benefit, mostly, Israel is quite unlikely to fully cut off the Palestinian Authority or the West Bank.
Colleen, let's turn for a second to some of the external factors here. Do you think that Israel is going to start to pressure its partners, its foreign partners, including the United States, to suspend aid to the Palestinian Authority?
Yeah, in fact, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has already called for isolation of the new Palestinian government, but it's unlikely that much of the international community will heed this call. The EU, for one, a big aid donor, has already recognized the unity administration, provided it shows some commitment to a set of diplomatic conditions related to the peace process. And even US officials have already said that they are willing to work with the new administration.
Finally, Colleen, let me ask you whether Iran and Hezbollah might grow unhappy with this arrangement inside the Palestinian Authority and make mischief of one sort or another to try to disrupt the unity government?
It doesn't seem likely. Firstly, some media reports have suggested that Iran may have had some form of involvement or other in calibrating Hamas's stance towards the government deal. And some officials have spoken out about how they actually support this ideal. In fact, the sort of setup that the Palestinians have reached in this government deal is a little bit reminiscent of the absorption of Lebanese militant party Hezbollah into the political sphere in Lebanon. Secondly, Iran and Hezbollah's relationship with Hamas tend to be fairly pragmatic in nature, and Hezbollah in particular currently has bigger things to worry about than the Palestinian issue, not least, obviously, the conflict in Syria.
Fantastic. Middle East analyst Colleen Shepp, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
We end this week with a festival of sport, or we hope so at least. The run-up to the World Cup in Brazil has featured a good deal of hand-wringing about the possibility of social unrest, like that which erupted last summer during Brazil's dress rehearsal for this big event, the 2013 Confederations Cup. As those invested in the huge Brazilian market already know, moving around safely is a challenge on the best of days. But with Brazil's president, Dilma Rousseff, facing re-election later this year and economic growth crawling along, some fear the stage may be set for more than football. So joining me from Sao Paulo is our Brazil analyst, Tomás Favaro. Tomás, there's a lot of concern around the world about the potential for the kind of street protests and low-level violence that we saw last summer. So can you give me some context? What should we be worried about if we are businesses either in Brazil or heading into Brazil for the Cup?
So support for the protest movement has actually decreased if you look at the opinion polls. So we went down from a peak of 81% in June 2013 when they first broke out to 57% in April, which is the latest figure available. This means that the usual, let's say, first-time protesters who took the streets in June 2013 is probably less likely to do so during the World Cup. So all in all, we do expect a smaller protest movement that will be less capable of causing disruptions to business. Having said that, you know, companies operating in central areas in the 12 host cities should monitor our alerts closely and monitor reliable local media to make sure that they are aware of when these incidents could take place so they can have contingency plans in place once they occur.
What about for general visitors? I mean, whether they are, you know, multinational corporations who've created an opportunity for their employees to go to the World Cup, or whether this is just an average tourist, what kind of atmosphere are they entering in Brazil? Is it better or worse than usual in terms of the risks of petty crime and kidnapping?
So one thing to bear in mind is that even in a normal day, Brazil is a very violent country. Even for Latin American standards, you know, crime rates in Brazil are pretty high. So will crime be a concern during the World Cup? Yes, absolutely. You know, we're talking about a huge influx of as much as 600,000 foreign tourists on top of as much as 3 million internal tourists. That obviously creates targets for criminals. The security forces are also aware of that, and the government is deploying in addition 100,000 security forces to the 12 host cities, including members of the army, federal and state police forces. So we do not expect this sort of an uptick in crime during the tournament due to this heavy patrolling in the streets.
Well, Tomás Favaro, good luck to you, but good luck to my team, the United States.
Mike, that's it for this edition of the Risk Map podcast produced by Control Risks, the global political integrity and security risk consultancy. Our podcast is available every other Friday on iTunes or via our website, www.controlrisks.com. You can sign up for a free trial of our country risk forecast and prime analysis. It's how global professionals track risk daily. From London, I'm Charles Hecker, signing off for now.
And on behalf of my colleagues in Control Risk's 36 offices around the world, this is Michael Moran in New York saying so long.